Today, we are going to discuss the LSC reduction formula. And LSC stands for Lehman, Symancyk, and Zimmermann, who first derived this formula. And so this is the first of four lectures we'll devote to learning how to compute scattering amplitudes. Or scattering cross sections. So our starting point today is going to be a scattering amplitude. And we're going to relate that to a time-ordered expectation value of products of fields. Then tomorrow, of interacting fields. Tomorrow we'll see how to relate that time-ordered product of interacting fields to time-ordered products of free fields, which you already know how to compute. Expectation values of products of free fields. So the only new thing then is to learn how to relate the time-ordered products of free fields to just products of free fields, which we'll also do tomorrow. And we actually did compute the simplest time-ordered product of free fields, the Feynman propagator, yesterday. And so ultimately, what we're going to do is we're going to relate amplitudes to expressions involving Feynman propagators and some other factors. Then next week, we will put it all together, see a simpler way to calculate all this using the technique of Feynman diagrams. And from there, we can relate the amplitudes to observable quantities. So it's a big picture of why we're doing what we're doing. So today, our starting point is going to be a scattering amplitude. And so there's a few different ways we can write this. So in the Heisenberg picture, what we want to compute is the amplitude or the overlap between some final state and the time evolution of some initial state. So in this particular context, when we're evolving an initial state all the way to a final state, basically time evolution from minus infinity to infinity. We denote the time evolution operator as S. And this is what's called the S matrix. So this is the same thing as in the Schrodinger picture, looking at the overlap between some final state evaluated at t equals infinity with an initial state evaluated at t equals minus infinity. So in the free theory, the S matrix is very simple. It's just the identity. There's no scattering. We have no interactions in a free theory. That's what we mean by a free theory. So our states in the Heisenberg picture, if we just time evolve them, there's no change in the states. So what we're really interested in an interacting theory are the off-diagonal parts of the S matrix, which are often denoted as T for transfer matrix. So this is ultimately what we're going to be computing. And of course, computing the entire transfer matrix all at once would be great, but that's exceedingly difficult. So we're often going to have a more limited goal in mind and just compute elements of this matrix. We know that this the transfer matrix should vanish unless form momentum is conserved. Even in quantum field theory, we expect that total momentum is conserved. We can create and destroy particles, but not for momentum. So T matrix should vanish unless the total four momentum is conserved. And so in order to save us some writing and prevent us having to write the momentum conserving delta function all the time, we often just pull out this overall factor and instead compute the matrix element M. This is not yet the matrix element. This is just a matrix. But as I said before, computing the entire matrix is very difficult. So what we often do is just compute some particular matrix element, which, using our definitions here, is 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 sigma m I f m I. And this is what we call the matrix element. So this is one component of the S matrix. It tells us about the amplitude for some initial state to transition into some final state. So that's going to be our goal for the next few lectures, is to learn how to compute this quantity. Okay, so this is what we're trying to compute. We'll come back to this time evolution operator, but the first thing we need to do is to think a little bit more carefully about which states we want to consider for our initial and final states. So ultimately, we're going to be interested in scattering. And so when we're scattering, we're usually sending two particles in and we get n particles out. For now, so how can we describe initial and final states like that? So far, all we've learned about is the free theory. So in the free theory, we know how to describe position eigenstates and momentum eigenstates with any number of particles. It's going to be convenient in order to compute the scattering to construct wave packets that are neither momentum eigenstates nor position eigenstates, but are approximately localized in both momentum space and position space. The reason we want to do this will simplify some of our the boundary, how much we'll have to think about the boundary conditions. If we the derivation of this formula can be done in terms of the position or momentum eigenstates, but it gets a little bit subtle considering the boundary conditions. So let's construct some wave packets. So in the free theory, we can construct a wave packet, which I'll creation operator that creates a wave packet that's some integral of some function of momentum times our creation operator, which creates a momentum eigenstate. Now, it won't matter very much precisely what function we have here. If you'd like to think about something concrete, we can imagine that we have some Gaussian that is peaked around some momentum k1 and has some variance sigma. So all I'm going to use about this function basically is that it's peaked about some momentum k1. So if we act with this operator A1 of t on the vacuum state, what we get is a wave packet. And will be localized in momentum space near K1. And let's assume that it's localized in position space near the origin at t equals 0. So I won't really be using any other properties of K other than these two. Just assume that it's localized. This wave packet is localized in momentum space near K1, and at t equals 0, the state is localized in position space near the origin. So using this idea, straightforward too, in the free theory to construct a two-particle state that could be either our initial or final state. So for instance, we can construct the state A1 dagger of t, A2 dagger of t, acting on the vacuum state. And if K1 is not equal to K2, this state describes two widely separated particles in the far past or the far future that both have some large probability to be near the origin at t equals 0. And so this seems like a good state to consider for either our initial or our final state for scattering. Unfortunately, in the free theory, there is no scattering. There's no interactions. So we need to generalize this sort of approach to the interacting theory. So what's going to change if we deal with the interacting theory? So the first thing is that the vacuum is going to change. So in the free theory, denote the vacuum as 0. In the interacting theory, I'll always denote the vacuum as omega. So we'll see in more detail how this works tomorrow. But it's not surprising that the vacuum changes. If in quantum mechanics you have some free Hamiltonian, you add a perturbation to that, in general, you'll change the vacuum state. So the same thing is going on here. We will discuss this in much more detail tomorrow. And so we expect that the same kind of construction of wave packets can work as long as these states are still one particle states. This is an assumption, though. And while we'll ultimately be able to make this work, we will need to be very careful to make sure that these states are, in fact, one particle states. And so for now, I'm going to assume this. And the later part of the lecture, we'll come back and think much more carefully about this. So with that assumption, yes, we will still assume that they annihilate the vacuum. Okay, so given this, we can write down our initial states and our final state for 2-to-2 scattering. And I haven't really been careful about the normalization of F up there, so I'm not going to be careful of the normalization of the states now either. So, but our two-particle state, assuming the same idea works, should be A1 of minus A1 dagger of minus infinity, A2 dagger of minus infinity, acting on the vacuum. And our final state should be A3 dagger at plus infinity, A4 dagger at plus infinity omega. So again, we'll check this more carefully, but our assumption right now is that these are one particle states, so these should also be two particle states. So what we want now is to compute F S I or F S minus 1 I. We're only really interested in the case I and F are not the same, so it doesn't really matter if we put a minus 1 here or not. And to do that, we need to time evolve these operators or time evolve these states. And we'll talk more about the time evolution operator in general tomorrow. Really, all we need is the following useful identity that relates the creation operators at plus infinity and minus infinity. So this will be enough to allow us to compute this amplitude. Okay, so this gives us the difference between the operator that creates a wave packet at plus infinity and at minus infinity. It's just related to an integral of the Klein-Gordon operator acting on the field. You may be concerned that this just gives us zero. So our Klein-Gordon equation yesterday was that this is just zero, but that was only true for the free theory. So what we mean by an interacting theory is we add extra interaction terms to our Lagrangian, which changes our Hamiltonian, gives us new terms in our equation of motion. So this is no longer zero in the interacting theory. Of course, it's not terribly surprising that the right-hand side is zero in the free theory because there's no really interesting dynamics. So we shouldn't get scattering amplitudes where the initial state is different from the final state in the free theory. Mary Jane? A1 is also a single particle state. AK creates a momentum eigenstate. A1 creates a wave packet that's partially localized in momentum space, partially localized in position space, but has a non-zero variance in either one.
So this interpretation is similar to particles that approach the origin. Wouldn't you have to put time dependence into the function f? to get the localizations to move with time? In what sense are they moving with time
well,
in space?
Well, so the creation operators, momentum space creation operators are time dependent in that equation. So
sure.
we're in the Heisenberg picture. I think nothing in my argument would prevent us putting explicit time dependence in F. So I'm not.
I just want to understand this example though, because I think isn't the time dependence in A that you mentioned that because that's the creates a momentum eigenstate. It's not clear to me that that time dependence alone would cause movement in the spatial localization.
Well, so the components of A1 with different momentum, you can think of it as breaking up into components that have different momenta. And so we're adding the time dependence of the momentum eigenstates depends on the energy of the particle. So AK creates a particle with energy EK. And the time dependence of in the free theory of AK is just e to the I EKT. And so if we sum up waves that have different time dependence, if we look at the sum at different times, spatial distribution will be changing too.
Okay.
We can talk more later, but yeah, nothing would. I'm not going to use really any facts about F1 other than it just creates a phase.
Well, I'm just thinking if you increase the time a little bit, that would just change the phase of each part, right? So I don't see why when you look at the state in space, in position space, it would move.
So the expectation value won't move, but the variance will change.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So this is going to be the key formula we need in order to compute this amplitude. And let's see why this is where this identity comes from. Okay, so first thing we can do is use the fundamental theorem of calculus to write this as an integral dt partial 0 a1 dagger of t. And then we need to make some assumption about how A1 is related to our fields. And the assumption we're going to make is that the relationship between these creation operators and the field operators is precisely the same one that you derived in tutorial yesterday for the free theory. So this is our assumption. So neither the operators AK nor the field operators phi are going to be the same in the interacting theory as in the free theory. But if they both change in a way that still satisfies this equation, then that's possible, and we're going to assume that that's the case. That will essentially allow us, it's equivalent to the assumption that both AK and phi will create one particle states. So if we make that assumption that this relation you derived yesterday in the free theory still holds, we can write this, just plug that in, and combine the d3x we have in this equation with the dt we've got here to get d4x. Then we have the derivative of the integrand over there. So we can evaluate this time derivative. And the next few steps are not going to involve any of these integrals. So let's just look at this part. We can evaluate this time derivative. We get four terms. So one term we get is if this derivative x on 5x, so we get partial squared 5x. We get another term if the derivative x on e to the ikx, and we multiply that by e to the ik 5x. And so that gives us a plus ek squared 5x. We get two more terms, and minus I e to the minus I e k d0 5x when we act with the derivative on this, multiplied by this term. We also get a plus I e to the e k x d0 5x when the derivative x on this term. Those two cancel. So this is all we get. Then we can write this as I'm going to include the integral here. We can write this as e to the minus I k dot x d0 squared 5x, and write ek as k squared plus m squared 5x. Which we can write, k squared is the same thing we would get if we acted with 2 minus grad squared acting on this exponential part, which we can integrate twice by parts to get the gradients squared acting on phi. So this gives us minus grad squared plus m squared acting on phi of x. And now we've got just what we want. So we can combine the d0 squared with the di squared and get the Klein-Gordon operator. So this is equal to integral d4x d squared plus m squared 5x. And that's precisely what we want.
Yes. I don't understand how you can make that assumption on the top of this.
This assumption. So basically, we still want, in the interacting theory, AK dagger to create a one-particle momentum eigenstate and 5x to create a one-particle position eigenstate. More or less restricts the relation between the operators to take something that's at least pretty close to this form.
But the way we derived it was we assumed a certain expansion for phi of x and then phi of x, and then we calculated this, right?
Yep.
But that was only taken from the Klein-Gordon equation.
That's right. That was taken from the Klein-Gordon equation, but we can always, if we assume that AK creates a momentum eigenstate, then if we Fourier transform it, we should get a position eigenstate, and that's another way, basically, that's really the assumption that's going in here. So we're assuming that AK creates a momentum eigenstate, 5x creates a position eigenstate, and they should really just be related by Fourier transforms. So that's enough to get this. So we also need the same relation for the annihilation operators. And it's basically the same derivation. We just get different signs, as you would expect. These operators are just the conjugate of the creation operators. So signs of the i's change. So only difference is this sign and this sign, as you would expect. OK, so now we are ready to compute FSI. And so based on our assumption, this is just A4 plus infinity A3. At plus infinity, A1 dagger at minus infinity, A2 dagger at minus infinity. And an important observation is that these operators are already time ordered. So I am free to insert the time ordering symbol in front of all of the creation and annihilation operators. I haven't changed anything by doing so. Okay, so now we're ready to use the identities. The identities are rather lengthy, so let's introduce some shorthand. So I will rewrite these two identities as A1 dagger of minus infinity is A1 dagger of plus infinity plus this integral, which I'll call A1, I1 dagger. And this is, I1 is just the right-hand side of this equation. It's just this. Minus this. And similarly, I'll call this expression here I1. So A4 plus infinity is A4 of minus infinity plus I4. Just some introducing some shorthand. Okay, so let's in this compact form, let's plug the identity into our amplitude. And what we get are a whole lot of terms. I'm not going to write them all down. Let's just look at a few of them. So the first term is where we get only creation or annihilation operators on the right-hand side and no i's. And so this term still has the time ordering. So that means we can move A3 and A4 past A1 and A2. This is time ordered. So we're not using the commutation relations. We just bring A3 and A4 to the right, where they reach the vacuum and annihilate it. So this term is 0. We get a whole lot of other terms that involve between 1 and 3 creation and or annihilation operators. Those are all 0 by the same argument. If they have any annihilation operators, those are evaluated at minus infinity. So they, through the time ordering, are just brought to the ket vacuum where they annihilate it. And if they contain any creation operators, those are just brought to the all the way to the left by the time ordering where they annihilate the Brah vacuum. So all of these terms that contain one or more creation or annihilation operators are 0, and we're just left with this last term that contains only the i's. Okay. And so the reason we introduced these wave packets was to avoid some issues with boundary conditions in this derivation. And so we're now free to just go back to momentum eigenstates. We can take F1 of k to be a delta function. And if we do that, this simplifies the expression for these integrals. So if f is a delta function, we can do this k integral very easily. And what we're left with is just a spatial integral. And Now the momentum becomes K1. And where this derivative is the derivative with respect to x1. Okay. And this gives us the celebrated LSE reduction formula. So I'll just write down our final result in a method that, in a way that will suggest how to generalize it to n to m scattering. So first of all, we have factor of I for each of the incoming particles, factor of I for each of the outgoing particles. Product over all of the particles, the two incoming and two outgoing. And integral over position, one for each of the particles, e to the minus I lambda j. Lambda is just a sign. So lambda j is minus 1 for final states, and plus 1 for initial states. And that just came from the fact that for the initial states, we had these what I called I daggers. And for the final states, we didn't have a dagger. So that explains the sign here. Then we have Klein-Gordon operators for each of the fields. And this notation here means delta j squared is eta mu nu partial x j mu partial x j nu. So this j is referring to the particle number. It has nothing to do with the components. The Lorentz components of this derivative, it's still a Lorentz invariance derivative. And each of these integrals and derivatives are acting on a time-ordered product of fields. And so here my notation means just phi I is phi of xi. And this is a compact notation that I'll be using a lot. Okay. So this is the LSE reduction formula. And what it says is that if we want to compute an amplitude, we need to learn how to compute time-ordered expectation values of time-ordered products of fields. And that's basically our goal for tomorrow. So that's why we want to do that. Are there any questions on this before we take a short break? Okay.
So why do we make that assumption of the last second form?
This? Yeah. This assumption?
Yeah.
Basically, this is because we want both phi of x and a k to create one particle states. So the second half of lecture today will be devoted to critically examining the assumptions that went into this. And we'll find that we're going to have to modify our theory a bit from what we might naively expect in order to make this work. Mary Jane.
I'm just not sure how you get, how you wrote this last formula from what you had before.
So basically, the only term that survives in this expression is this one that contains the product of the four i's. And so basically what I did in the last step was, first, in the i's, I made the replacement that f1 becomes a delta function. That allows me to simplify the expression for the i's. I can do the k integral. And then I just plugged in here. I introduced some new notation just so it didn't take up the entire blackboard. But I haven't done any more algebra besides this simplification and plugging in. So in the second part of today's lecture, I'd like to critically examine some of the assumptions that went into the derivation of the LSC reduction formula. So we made assumptions that even in the interacting theory, this is a one particle state, as are these states. So these were two of our assumptions. We assumed that both of these are one particle states. Let's try to examine that. So as we saw in the free theory, one of the properties that we expect one particle state should satisfy is that one particle states should be orthogonal to the vacuum state. So let's take a look at the overlap between this one particle state and the vacuum state. And to do that, it's useful to rewrite this operator in terms of translation operators.
But unfortunately, there's absolutely nothing that guarantees this is zero, and in general, it won't be zero. Okay, so that's could be a big problem, is what I just told you in the first half. Nonsense. Not really, we can fix this easily. So let's suppose that omega phi zero is some number. So this should be Lorentz invariant. Scalar field. These are everything here is Lorentz variant. So this would be a Lorentz variant number. And we can't use our result from the first half of the lecture if this is not a one-particle statement. That was one of the assumptions that went into our lecture. But if we redefine our field, we say phi tilde of x is phi of x minus v, then even if phi of x doesn't create a one-particle state, phi tilde of x will create a one-particle state, or at least a state that is orthogonal to that, and has a chance of being a one-particle state. So this means that omega tilde of x omega is zero. But tilde has a chance of being one particle state. As long as we want to shift the field, we still have a chance to get out of five x being one particle state.
That this expectation value is not zero, is that an effect of the fact that we have an interacting theory?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In the free theory, this would be zero. In free theory, we do know how to compute this, and this would be zero. We haven't yet learned how to compute these expectation values with interacting fields and interacting vacuums, but we'll do tomorrow. But it is true, and we'll see tomorrow, that in the general interacting theory, this is not true.
And also the P in the second line with hat, what is that?
It's the momentum operator that you derive. Or in this way, or you drive three components of it. All four, if you drive the Hamilton.
So even though we know that this state is like orthogonal to vacuum state, how can we guarantee this one is a one particle state? It might be, for example, a two particle state or the superposition of one particle state.
We're not done yet, we'll get there.
Oh.
A very good point. Wait.
But if the interacting field is consist of the like linear superposition of the creating annihilation operator, like it has to get zero anyway. But like if it is not a zero, does that mean that phi of zero contains the term inside the integral that is not product that multiplied either of creation or annihilation operator?
Well, so our vacuum, yeah. It has to contain something. So remember, we argued that we could still write it like this based on the fact that both of them created one particle state. So it's not clear that this expression still holds. If phi doesn't create a one particle state, and thus, if it doesn't hold, it must contain something other than just a theory.
Do we lose some physics if we use phi of tilde x instead of phi of x all the time?
No. If we're interested in the physics of phi of x, we could always go back and compute what the is. This means that if we want to use the LSE formula, we need, at least in the form that I wrote it down, we need to use phi tilde instead of phi. But we're ultimately interested in phi. But the shift really isn't something physical. So, and we'll see more why that is. There are some reasons you might be interested in something other than quantum fractals. You could do your calculations in terms of quantum fractals. you want to get the opposite problem.
Is it clear that the vacuum is translation invariant that you have from interacting theory?
This is an assumption. We're always kind of assume that there's no spontaneous breaking of Lorentz symmetry. Lorentz invariance is tested with very high precision by experiments, so it's possible that there be some small violations, but that's true. So we'll assume that there is. Okay. And in what follows, I'm just going to drop the topic. Otherwise, I would be writing Gilbert for the rest of the course. Okay. So, as Rodat pointed out, this is not enough to guarantee that this is one particle state. So let's look at its overlap with other one particle states. And then after that, we'll look at its overlap with multi-particle states. So what is the overlap between a momentum eigenstate and this state that we want to be a one particle position eigenstate? So you computed this in tutorial yesterday in the free theory, and what you found was that this is just e to the ikx. Okay. And we'd like this still to be true. And we can think of, so if this is true, then we can think of the momentum eigenstates as just Fourier transforms. So we hope this is still true. In the interacting theory.
When you write the vector, you mean three vectors. Maybe that should be a four vector k, right? Because it'd be a minus I, right? Just to be consistent, I think. Usually when you write four vectors, you don't write the vector symbol.
So if you specify the momentum of a one particle state, that's enough to specify
I see, okay.
Zero components.
So you don't care.
In my notation, A is equal to, I think most of the time I've been putting that there.
Okay.
If I leave it off.
For sure.
That's
okay.
What I mean.
So I remember there's a minus sign on the right if you just do it. Right. Okay.
So here this is the Heisenberg picture field operator. So if there was a vector sign here, minus sign,
sure.
So, say about this amplitude k phi of x omega in the interacting theory. Turns out, as for the overlap between vacuum and the one particle position eigenstate, not a lot. We can again rewrite this using the translation operator. And again, vacuum is translation invariant, and K is a momentum eigenstate, so here we just get the I K dot X. A by zero. Okay. And we'd like this to be one. Again, there's absolutely nothing that guarantees that this is run in an interactive theory. Not necessarily. However, the fix is just as easy as before. We can rescale our field. If this expectation value is amplitude is non-zero, so we can write spike tilde as some normalization times phi of x, which is constant. And for an appropriate choice of n, no matter what this form factor is, we can set it to 1 by rescaling it.
How can we be sure this is not 0?
So if it were 0, that's saying that there is no overlap between our position, our nominal position, one particle position, eigenstates of the eigenstates. We know it's true. We know it's 1 in the free theory, and if, assuming we're doing a small perturbation, don't expect to get 0. If it gets 0 for some reason, I think that would be telling us that perturbation is breaking down a large change. Something would be very wrong with it.
And these three definitions that we do here, they're compatible with the canonical computation relations. So this one would affect the canonical momentum, for example, right? It has to transverse, has to be scaled inversely or something like this.
That's right.
Right? Okay.
These are, in fact, it's necessary to do this. Well, at least in order to be able to communicate. The LSE formula is one of our key tools in computing things perturbatively in quantum field theory. So it may not look like we simplify things very much, but our goal for tomorrow is to be able to do this. And we'll see that, in fact, we can relate this to this expectation value to expectation on the time order products of free fields. It's a huge simplification. You already almost know how to do this. So, and again, I'm going to draw. So, another thing we need to check is that our one particle states are orthogonal to our multiple particle states. So, what are our multiple particle states? So, write a general multiple particle state. Follows. So I'll denote by P the total free momentum. A general three particle or n particle state needs a lot more parameters to completely specify the states and just the total momentum, it's the relative momenta, and perhaps if we're dealing with many types of particles, we might need other parameters to describe what types of particles, spins, and things like that. But I'll just lump those all together into a other single parameter sigma, which describes everything else. We're only really going to be interested. interested in the Lorentz transformation properties. And so we want this overlap. Be zero. And we're using the familiar procedure, and simplify this a little bit, but not terribly much. Trying to impose slightly too strong a condition.
In this whole process, are we like kind of demanding that the vacuum expectation and the form factor to be equal to the case of the free theory? So redefinition of the field still like solve the equation of motion and like doesn't change the physics, but we are kind of making better field, like, is it
right? Essentially, what we're doing is changing the normalization of our fields. What we're finding out is that we're forced to renormalize our fields.
Then, the Lagrange density is originally defined in terms of the non-tilde fields, right? So, can we just substitute those redefinitions without any correction?
I'll comment more on that later. Near the end of the lecture, I'll comment on that. It's a good question, but trying to impose slightly too strong a condition. So we're demanding that the overlap between a momentum eigenstate and a position eigenstate is zero. Really, what we just need is the overlap between the Moncler particle momentum eigenstates and a one particle momentum eigenstates. Should be zero. Sorry, this is the wave packet. But really, what we just want, this even is too strong. Because the momentum eigenstates are not normalizable. A sufficient condition is that our one particle wave packets are orthogonal to multi particle wave packets. The both of these are normalizable, and since they're normalizable states, we don't have to worry that non zero overlap against some artifact that's not related to normalization. So, this is what we're overlap. Easier. Okay, and same author part of the way. Okay, so integral d3p 2 pi by Q's V naught plus K naught I star sigma P F1 P A sigma of B E three I this last factor is the important one of K naught minus K naught. So why is this last factor important? So remember P naught refers to the energy of a multi-particle state, which is P squared plus M squared half, where big M is the invariant mass of the n-particle state. And K naught is the energy of the one particle state, which is P squared plus M squared half. And if we make one further assumption, there are no bound states.
In general, that the overlap between a one particle state that we've created with the position, like with phi, with the field, that the overlap of that and the multi particle state that we've created with the A dagger, that this overlap is non zero.
Which has to be the case if we're going to allow particle number violating processes. So, imposing that one particle state could never turn into a multi-particle state, or vice versa, would have been forbidding. That's why our original another reason why our original constraint on the overlap between the one particle state and multi particle state was too strong.
So in the free theory, this is always zero.
This is always zero. What we really want is our asymptotic states. So that's really the only time in which we can actually say how many particles we have in the set. Plus or minus infinity when things are far apart and we can check. But if we have a whole bunch of particles going together, particles can be created, destroyed, then question of how many particles there are.
Is there such thing in, because we've been worrying about whether our particle states are one particle states or not. Is there such thing as a particle number operator in an interaction?
There is. It's the same operator that we had before. So we wrote that down. It was the integral of eta. It's the same number of operators, but before, in the free theory, we saw that the number operator commuted with the Hamiltonian. That's no longer the case in the interaction theory. So the number operator, no, the particle number is not conserved.
Okay. Now the states that we are considering now no longer are eigenstates of that operator.
That's right. So just want to summarize briefly and. Hopefully provide a partial answer to Wanjian's question from earlier. So let's look at a concrete example of an interacting theory. We'll come back to and study again later. So, good. And a phi cubed interaction term to our Klein-Gordon prime. If you want to compute anything using perturbation theory, in particular, if you want to use the LSC reduction formula, we will have to shift and rescale our field in order for the LSC reduction formula to hold, in order for phi to fit one particle state. So, although naively we might think that it's okay just to add this extra interaction term, if we add an interaction term, we also have to shift and rescale. And so this, we're just adding the term, one extra term is a naive thing to do. We've tried to argue it's inconsistent. And so in general, we have to shift and rescale. And after we do that and rename some of the constants, what we'll be left with is the Lagrangian or something like this. So not only do we introduce some extra multiplicative constants, we even get a new term if we have the shift. What is this telling us? This is telling us that renormalization is required. It's not consistent to do perturbation theory using our original Lagrangian with just some new interaction terms in general. Not a consistent thing to do. We'll spend much more time discussing this issue in Q52. I will come back to this briefly in my final lecture before I hand this over to Jacob. but we spent more than a week on this 52. But for now, we're essentially going to ignore this issue. We're going to ignore and assume that our field phi does create a properly normalized one particle state, so that this is zero. This form factor is 1, e to the ikx. And in other words, all zi's are 1 and y is 0. This is not necessarily a consistent choice, as I've tried to argue. However, what I'm doing is not completely inconsistent, because, in fact, these choices are okay as long as we only deal with the leading order of perturbation theory. So at leading order, this is okay. Once we go beyond leading order, it's completely inconsistent. So so keep that in mind. Keep that in mind as we're going along. So these choices that we make are only consistent. These choices here that because the i's are 1 and y is 0 is only consistent if you're doing leading order perturbation theory. Once you go to the next leading order, we have to worry about all of these things and they're normalized. And so tomorrow we are going to examine the right-hand side of the LSE reduction function and learn how to compute those time ordered products of fields. Any questions?
Yes. Like the part I cannot really understand is like we solve the original Lagrangian first, and then we get the different Lagrangian the rest. I mean, like when we solve the problem, which Lagrangian should we use?
So to answer your question, so if you want to do quantum field theory beyond leading order perturbation theory, this second Lagrangian is the only one that makes sense. So at leading order, in perturbation theory, it doesn't matter which one you use. And doing classical physics is basically the same thing as doing, it's related to doing the leading order perturbation theory in quantum field theory. So again, it doesn't really matter which one of these you use if you're doing classical theory, and because that's in the classical limit, basically all of the z's become 1 and less 2.
Then why we didn't write down the second Lagrangian at the first time, and like why we write down the first Lagrangian and then do some stuff to correct it, rather than just write
just
down?
Rescaling.
Well, it's not at all obvious that we have to do this in order for perturbation theory to make sense. Or, for instance, if we're doing perturbation theory in quantum mechanics, it's okay just to add a new term to the analytic. If you do perturbation theory like that, we don't necessarily have to rescale. Oh shit, this is something new. Maybe you could have seen it coming, but for most people, it's
The parameters y and z are functions of the coupling g, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That part, we basically scale the field and then to make that function into 1, right? And
yes.
But in general, the k can vary, so how can we guarantee that after rescaling it satisfies all the k?
So actually, this quantity, k phi 0 omega, that's the Lorentz invariant. We've we've normalized all of our fields, but all the amplitudes are Lorentz invariant. So that's to be Lorentz invariant. The only thing it can depend on is k. So it really, it has to depend on k squared, it's just m squared. So it can't, even though it can depend on k only in the combination of k squared, that really works.
You have like zi equals one, and does that mean that like each zi is a different particle? Like,
so the zi's are referred to what I wrote here, z phi, zm, and zg. Okay. Z's are rescaling, or correspond to rescaling a field or parameter, and the y's are new terms that you get that aren't there, and not equal.
So the Lagrangian just for one particle, then?
This is the Lagrangian just for a single particle. So these z phi is just a coefficient.
Can you explain why this inner product is Lorentz invariant? Because the operator phi zero itself, is that Lorentz invariant?
That's Lorentz invariant.
Is a vacuum Lorentz invariant?
Sorry. Vacuum is Lorentz invariant. Yes.
So it definitely seems like the state k on the left should be Lorentz covariant, right?
Right.
So if phi and vacuum are Lorentz invariant and k is Lorentz covariant, then why?
So we construct things that all are.
How can you see that? Because it seems like you're kind of, the logic seems kind of circular because we're trying to construct the one particle states right now, right?
Yeah.
Phi zero is invariant after boosting. So, vacuum is invariant after boosting. And so, in general, you can just boost it to anything. You just use the boost, you don't use it.
But if you're boosting, then the state on the left will change, right? The state on the left, the k, it's a momentum eigenstate. If you boost,
you just consider that factor. I mean that like k phi zero omega.
Yes.
This whole thing is you can boost it to any k you want. So in general, it's just a function of k squared. It doesn't depend.
Well, why couldn't it just be a function of k? Why can't it just be?
The question is the vacuum that I need to do. It's because phi zero, you can use both. After boosting, phi zero still go to phi zero, and vacuum still go to vacuum. But your k go to like any k you want.
Yeah. So why can't it be a function of k, not k squared?
Well, it must be a function of k squared.
Why?
Because after boosting, this whole thing must be a scalar. So after boosting, like it doesn't change, and it can go to any k. So it must be a function.
So are you saying you can't construct? Any scale you construct from K has to be Lorentz invariant? Or, I mean, that seems kind of...
Yes, yeah.
No, I could take the absolute value of K, right? That would change.
Then that's just K squared.
Sorry. So I was thinking of the three-vector K. Okay, so I'll think about it.
Any other questions? Okay, see you this afternoon.